the Miracle Mets of 1969 baseball?
You're talking to the wrong person, wrong people.
Yeah, as I was writing these down, I was like, oh, this is going to be a real mistake that you're making, because you can't speak of these authoritatively.
You can't even fake knowing these.
Welcome to Keep It Fictional, a weekly podcast for book lovers by book lovers. Build your to-be-read list with Sadie, Liz, Virginia, Fiona, and Corrine from the Port Moody Public Library. Warning, this podcast contains strong opinions and may cause an increase in your library holds list.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Keep It Fictional, your favorite question mark library-based book podcast, I hope. I don't know, maybe New York Public Library has something going on better, but do they have these faces? Do they have this energy? Do they have these strong of opinions that they're willing to just put out there? No. You joined us for a very special episode because it's just me and Virginia today. Me being Corrine, if you are listening to this, is just me and Virginia today through kind of like a mystical set of circumstances. You get, honestly, the two polemics of this podcast of people who don't usually have very similar opinions. So I feel like you're going to get some very different books today. Virginia, how are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. I feel like, you know, maybe speaking of the theme, people don't appreciate this as much they should. That's why none of them are here. But yeah,
they're not here, so they can't talk. Are you looking forward to the long weekend? Is it going to be a bookish long weekend?
Oh, it's definitely bookish long weekend. Like, every week we got like books, you know, new books that arrived at the library. And so, you know, because luckily for Corrine and I, we both do ordering. So we always get to see what we order, and we always get to be the first people to put things on hold. So yesterday, after all the books were checked in, like, you know, I have a stack about this month. So I'm pretty set for this. So I'm quite excited about that. How about you?
Yes. Yeah, so every year at the library, we have to submit to Virginia as kind of like this little contest, like our top books of the year. And also for the podcast, we have to kind of do our top books of 2023. And so usually around this time, I'm in a total panic because I've spent the year kind of like leisurely reading backlist. And then I'm like, uh-oh, you've read two books published this year. And so you've got to read a lot. So I'm under kind of like a crunch here. I'm going to have to really read them, and they're all going to have to be good, as well as I'm very excited. I know I'm not allowed to talk about art books anymore, but I put a ton of them on hold at Vancouver Public Library, and all my holds have come in. And so I'm going to spend the weekend kind of one on my left hand reading a book about like art theft, art heists, and art plagiarism. And then on my right hand, rapidly reading every single book published in 2023.
Did you just say you're borrowing books from another library, Trader?
Oh, okay. Real talk. It's because if I order them through interlibrary loan, I cannot finish them all in 3 weeks because, as we have discussed on this podcast, I'm very much a mood reader. And so if I'm not in the mood to read it, I don't. And so it like sits there like an accursed owl, like staring down at me, making me feel guilty and bad. And so I only do this every once in a while, but I go to VPL and I grab a stack of books and they just can sit in my house for a while.
Is that how I meet an owl? Because I've never had an owl in my life other than like stuffed owl. So is that how I can meet a real one? Is that I just like have these interlibrary loans sitting at my house that I'm not reading and this owl will show up and judge me? Yes?
I mean, the owl is very much a personification of my guilt, but yes?
I like your guilt. I'm going to try that. I have a couple interlibrary loans out right now. I'm going to have to try that. Just put them aside and not read them.
Is there anyone in particular that you're like really excited for this weekend?
I still have to finish my biography of Clarice Lispector. You missed that episode when we do the scary books. And that was one of the authors that I discovered. And I'm obsessed with them right now. So interlibrary loan their biography, even though I never, ever read biography. So I have to go do that. And I was telling Sadie, because Sadie was the only one who was here at that time, I was reading my interlibrary loan. And then I was like, I was quite into it. I was reading on this side. And then I look over and very fittingly, there was a bug, squash bug inside my interlibrary loan, because the book that I read was the cockroach book, right? So it was just, there was a bug. So it's not a cockroach, I don't think. Not that I look very hard, but there was a bug that was squashed there. And I'm just like, okay, this is very fitting and also very gross. And then now I did a whole flip through of all the books just to make sure there's no more surprises hiding, waiting for me. But yes.
Gross.
Yes, it is gross. But also, like I said, very fitting that there was a bug in this one. So
do you think the person who squashed the bug in there did it on purpose, is to be like, oh, you like horror books, and she wrote The Cockroach, so wah, 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 wah.
Maybe. But yeah, bugs could show up in... let's not go there, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Pass. We're going to turn to something that I think for both of us is a little bit more pleasant to talk about, which is our topic for this episode that Virginia has alluded to, that is underappreciated books. So not kind of like your big bestsellers, not the ones that get the awards, ones that kind of like have flown under the radar, so to speak, but we believe that they need a little bit more love. So these are kind of like underdogs, which as I was doing research for this episode, I didn't realize that it's like in like response to the top dog expression. So like top dog and then the underdog because it's under the top dog. Yeah. So I put that together this morning and I think I should just go to sleep because nothing's really going to top that. Doing good. Yeah. Everyone loves an underdog story, like a Cinderella story. So like a David and Goliath, a Robin Hood. And okay, here's where some sports things I wrote down, but I don't actually know what they mean. Miracle on Ice, which I thought was like a figure skating thing, but I think it's like a hockey thing. Okay. The Miracle Mets of 1969. Baseball?
You're talking to the wrong person. Well, wrong people.
Yeah, as I was writing these down, I was like, oh, this is going to be a real mistake that you're making because you can't speak of these authoritatively.
You can't even fake knowing these.
I'm pretty sure the Mets are baseball.
I think so too, yeah. Give it is the same Mets, I think. But that's all I know about it, right? Well, that's all we need to know. Baseball.
Yeah, a baseball dark horse winner story. Yeah. Linked to underappreciated or, you know, like the underdog here. And so this is kind of a bit of a strange episode because honestly, most books are underdogs in the publishing world. So it's really actually tough to get a beat on how many books are published annually because that's an impossible calculation to make. So I've seen kind of the number floated around of like 50,000, no, 500,000 to 1 million books. Oh, sports and numbers. This is a rough episode already. To 1 million. And then with the advent of self-publishing, because that kind of changed the game a lot, it could be up to 4 million books a year. In Canada alone, in 2020, 10,400-ish books were traditionally published in Canada. And of those, not all of them are going to do very well. So if we think about kind of like the New York Times bestseller, which is like the height of kind of what we look for that gets published on like the front of books, it's like, oh, it's a New York Times bestseller. Well, snap. In order to kind of get that designation, and it's kind of some weird, shadowy conspiracy as to how they calculate this. I tried looking into it and it has to do with like special bookstores and special places. So it's not actually all bookstores and then it's not actually Amazon and there's some like weird math involved. But anyways, they have said in what few crumbs they have left for those like wishing to inquire is that you have to sell about 5,000 to 10,000 books a week, which is a lot of books. And of kind of like the new books published, fewer than 500 make it onto that list a year. So that's 0.5% of every book published makes it into a bestseller. So like the odds are against you. The odds are against you. And not every book, not every author can become like a TikTok sensation. Like that's the dream, right? Is that BookTok kind of picks up your book that's maybe like a mid-list title and kind of brings it into the spotlight and suddenly everyone's buying it and suddenly you're like Colleen Hoover and you're doing really well for yourself. On average, a published book will make for the author about $1,000 to $10,000. So all those dreams that you have of writing like the great Canadian novel and retiring to be a billionaire are not going to happen. Yeah, we're crushing dreams here. We're crushing dreams here, Virginia. On average, if you're kind of like, and when we say mid-list, it's kind of like a very like publishing term. There's like the big blockbuster bestsellers. And then there's mid-list authors who, I think the definition that I saw is that they're profitable, but not blockbusters. So they're not like your Danielle Steeles. They're not your James Pattersons. They're not Nora Roberts. Those are like the creme of the creme. These are authors that maybe they published a couple of books and they did okay. They did okay. They sold a couple thousand copies. They're probably making about $20,000 a year. And in order to do that, they have to sell 10,000 copies of a book, which is a lot in this day and age. Although I did see a statistic somewhere that Canadians buy the average of 2.6 books a year, which I feel like people sitting on this podcast definitely buy a lot more than that.
I think it's you and me, though. Right. I don't know if the other friends, I don't know if they buy books as much. I feel like maybe not as much.
Unless it's the eighth book in the series.
Exactly. Right. Like they will never buy the whole thing. So I don't know. Yeah. But I mean, like, at least it's nice to know that we work at a library. So we know that, you know, we can buy books for the library. And so that's good. But yeah, like it's must be hard. Like we were listening to, we have a writer's fest over the weekend, and one of the writers, K.S. Veloso, was doing one of the writing workshops, and she talks about how hard even just like being so constrained, not just about, you know, like selling your books, but also like the kind of books you could sell or that they would be willing to buy, right? Because she was saying like, you know, she has all these ideas, but it all really up to her editor. What do they think the market is selling? So she's like, it's so many factors that prevents your book from being, like you said, making up to that those lists is because they're just not quite what everybody is reading just at that moment, right? So it makes it, and it's just, you kind of never know. Like you look at some of these bigger books that came out, you're just like, why now? Like, you know, like, I mean, I'm sure you feel like it's just like a weird combination of things happening, like all the, I don't know, stars, planets, everything is aligning, right? So you just suddenly, this is the thing, right? But like, how did that happen? You know, so yeah. And then of course, then afterwards, it's like every book has to be like that before they would even consider you, which makes everything just so much more complicated. And that's why we need today's episode. I'm assuming that's why.
Nice tie-in, Virginia. Yeah, that was kind of my thesis statement. That's what I was working towards, is that, yeah, like in all of these, you know, up to 4 million books that are published every single year, like, I mean, there's nothing wrong with the blockbusters. They're there for a reason. They are there because they've built a consistent fan base. But I mean, there are those kind of mid-list authors that because someone championed it, because someone was passionate about it, because someone like recommended it, it slowly, 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 slowly built to kind of help that author get more publicity, kind of get their name out there so they can kind of like get out of that mid-list slump into more of a household name. But it's tough. It's tough. I think a lot of us, you know, if you're buying books a lot or kind of looking through the bookstores and stuff like that, you see those publishing trends. Like, okay, we're on to vampires again. Cool, 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 cool. Vampires, vampires, vampires. Like, and then like super sexy times after 50 Shades of Grey. And then like, it's the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. So that is very interesting because writing a novel is such like a huge endeavor. And like, I can see why those authors wouldn't be willing to like invest the time or the money into something that, you know, might not come to anything. Might not be picked up by their editor. So that's very interesting. Okay. Anyways, we have chosen some books that we love to talk about or authors, I think. I'm not sure because I came to work this morning and realized that the book that I was going to talk about, I've actually already talked about. So that's a bit awkward. So I have rapidly found one that I also agree more people should read. Yeah. And I don't know what Virginia has read and will talk about. So yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, it was hard to find because I think you're absolutely right that it's such a broad topic, and so many books need more love from us. And there's just so many choices. So my random process of elimination sort of goes like this. This was, I think, originally a Mark topic suggestion. It makes sense because he's like always talking about underappreciated books. So I thought, okay, I went with one of his go-to publishers and series, which is New York Review Book Classics. And on the publisher's webpage, on the About Us page, they actually talk about how one of the things that they wanted to do is to bring to English audience, very often through translation, books that you may not have heard of. Unheard stories. So that's kind of like part of the thing. So I thought that would fit this topic. And then I went back to make sure that on Goodreads to take a look and see, do these books have like a lot of ratings or reviews? I try to find ones that have fewer, because again, that means that they are underappreciated. So this is how I arrive at this collection of selected short stories by Silvina Ocampo and translated by Daniel Balderston. And this is Thus Were Their Faces, which I really love the title. I don't even know why, but Thus Were Their Faces. So Ocampo is, I feel like, was also a good choice for this topic because she's often described as the best kept secret of Argentine letters. She's often seen as being shadowed by her older sister, Victoria Ocampo, who is like a force in Latin American publishing. And of course, she's also being shadowed by her husband, who is also a writer, Adolfo Bio Casales, which really, I happen, speaking of IRL, I happen to actually IRL a novel, not realizing the connection and the relationship. So it was kind of a funny coincidence, one of the books I'm hoping to get to this weekend. But anyway, so I felt like, you know, all of this kind of contributed to this kind of underappreciation, especially in the English reading world. But I would say Silvina Ocampo sounds like, from what I read about her, sounds like she's very much what we would call a writer's writer. Writers loved her. She's admired by her contemporaries and also like Latin American authors that are writing right now. If you go on Goodreads to look up this book, one of the review would be from Sofia Moreno Garcia, who talks about like how much she loves her writing, right? So it's like, I feel like she's like recognized by her fellow writers, but not necessarily by readers just yet. And she's also endorsed by two literary giants. Jorge Luis Borges, who also wrote the preface to this particular collection, declared that Silvina Ocampo is one of the best writers. Her stories have no equal in our literature, which I feel like is pretty high praise. And Italo Calvino, once again fulfilling my promise to bring his name up as often as possible on the show, Miss Corrine, he said that no other writer better captures the magic inside everyday rituals, the forbidden or hidden face that our mirrors don't show us. And I feel like that is a really apt and perfect description of the kinds of stories and themes that you can expect from her collection. Now, Thus Were Their Faces contains 42 stories, and they're selected from 7 different short story collections that was published. And the translator, Balderston, actually know Ocampo quite well. And when selecting the stories to make available to an English audience, that was back in 1988, the guideline that Ocampo gave him was basically that, like, she insisted that we choose her cruelest stories. And this reference to the fact that one year they denied Ocampo Argentina's National Prize for Literature because the judges said that her stories were far too cruel. So that's kind of what she decided to kind of latch on. She's like, okay, well, let's find like the cruelest stories and we'll put it in our collection, which I think is a delightful thing to do. And cruel, I think, can be interpreted in many different ways. It is definitely darker stories. There's a lot of death and dying, murder, poison, everything you can find is in here. It's also like, I think, interpreted as kind of more strange or weird or surreal. But I think for me, the cruelty that she kind of put in her story, I feel like it's very much like the cruelty of a child. Is this combination of innocence and cruelty together? It's almost like these characters were maybe closer to their natural state in some way, that they haven't been contaminated yet by the world. They haven't been taught. They haven't been shown. They haven't been disciplined. And so they're acting in the way perhaps maybe closer to who they really are. And I think it's this combination of innocence and cruelty that really haunts her characters and makes her stories like really intriguing. For example, one of the stories called The Fury is about a man who's meeting his lover. For whatever reason, she always brings this kid along. It's not her kid. She's just somehow taking care of this child. And We're not really sure what the relationship is, but the kid is always here. But not only that, the kid always brings his drum with him. And this incessant drumming that he could hear constantly, even when she's not with this woman, she could just hear it and it just infuriates him. And he just wants to be alone with her. So he decided to do something about that. But of course, it didn't quite turn out the way he wants. Or in this other story called The Velvet Dress, it's about a seamstress who was helping this woman trying to fit into this velvet dress that she made. And it's a very short story, as this woman was like struggling to get in and get out of this dress. There's this like side kid that is there, and the kid is just like keep exclaiming throughout the story, "How amusing!" You know, like just throughout the thing. And it's just this weird, like kind of childlike voice that you hear from her stories that makes it so strange. There's also a supernatural feel to many of her stories. Again, going back to what another observation by Borges. He said that, like, oh, Campbell has this clairvoyance. He sees right through you. He sees through things. And often in her stories, you'll find characters like Campbell herself who accept and acknowledge the supernatural as part of reality, comparing with those who don't and refuse to and ignore the signs that there is something uncanny happening. In a story called The House Made of Sugar, for example, we have a soon-to-be married couple. They're looking for a place to live, and they find this perfect house. It is painted bright white, and it almost looks like sugar. And when there is sun shining on it, it's like this sugar crystal that are like glistening, and it just looks so beautiful. And they fell in love with this house. But the bride has a specific criteria for the house. It cannot be lived in by anyone else previously. It has to be a brand new house, because she thinks, and she was telling her soon-to-be husband, that if someone lives there before, then their lives will change my life. And it was interesting, as the groom pointed out, that she said, "my life, not their life." And this house, even though it looks brand new, actually was occupied previously. But it was so perfect. So the guy decided that, you know what, I'm not going to tell her. I'm just going to say this is a brand new house. Of course, then they moved in and things start happening. They're starting phone calls, looking for this previous person that lives there, probably called Violetta. And then there's like people start coming to visit, and the man is trying very hard to prevent the woman from like meeting these people, to answering the call. But of course, he can't be there all the time. And indeed, as the woman predicted, her life started to change. The title story, Dust Were Their Faces, is about a group of 40 or so kids who suddenly one day act and behave and think the same way. And at first, the adults thought it was just a prank, that they were copying each other, that they have agreed they are going to like give the same answers to the homework. They're going to dress all the same. When they were asked to draw something, they all draw angel wings. They thought it was just something that these kids are doing to make a joke. But it's not, of course. Something else is going on. And we found out when there was a plane crash. A lot of stories are very strange. Do I always know what I'm reading? Not really. Like, I don't always understand what's going on, but that's okay. I feel like some of them are just like, okay, well, it's what it is. I feel like it's more like the feeling of sort of some of these stories. Many of them are quite short. Many of them are like just a couple pages, very often not more than 10 pages. But I think it really showcased her talent, because Ocampo is also a poet. And I think it's just the way she can capture the essence of like an emotion or a bunch of emotion in like a single sentence, in one observation. She doesn't need lots of words, I think. And I find myself writing down her lines, because just there's something very special about the way she looked at things. For example, in one of the stories called A Strange Visit, it's about this father who's taking her daughter to go to this house somewhere remote to meet some people. The daughter doesn't know why her dad was there, but when she got there, she met a girl and they were playing together. And she talks about how she got lost in this girl's dress that has five pleats. And just like in those single sentences, you kind of understood the relationship between the two people. And I think that's people who can write really good short stories, I think, because short stories are often not about the plot development. It's often you drop into a scene, you drop into like a moment. And in that very small amount of space, you're suddenly immersed in the character. You know all the hopes and dreams about the people in the story. And that is what Ocampo excel at. She doesn't need to tell you a lot of things, but you feel everything from these characters and you feel like you know them so well in that one tiny moment in time. She also has a very good sense of humor. Like there was a story called Carl Hurst about two brothers who is trying to go see this guy, Carl Hurst, to buy a dog. And they met the dog. And they thought, oh yeah, this might be a good pet for us. And they went into the house and this guy's house is filled with pictures of dogs. And there's like just dog pictures and dog things everywhere. And they decide to go home and think about whether they should get this dog or not. And the next day they came back and they thought, okay, yes, we're going to get this dog. And the owner wasn't there, but the owner told the neighbor that, oh yeah, if these two guys came along, just tell them that dog is at the back, they can go, right? And so they went to the back and the dog came up to greet them and they thought, oh, this is great. And then they went into the dog house and there was like a picture of the guy in the dog house. And there was all these sayings like, you know, man won't betray you, a dog will, you know, and it's just all these like, you know, a man is your best friend and all that kind of like weird sayings. And it's just like just little things that makes you kind of feel like, okay, this is like a very interesting author that has a very interesting mind. There's another story that has like just two pages called Report on Heaven and Hell. It's basically about like, you know, how you get to heaven, how to get to hell. And the last line was basically, I know people who, because of a broken key or a wicker birdcage, went to hell. And others who, for a sheet of newspaper or a glass of milk, went to heaven. And it's that kind of like just weird observations that she has that I find myself keep reading. When I was reading more about her, I think The Guardian pointed out one of the story that was these two lovers that they were starting a conversation and they just met each other and they like don't really know how to talk. So they just kind of like, what should we talk about? Well, let's talk about picnics. Picnics where people who died after drinking wine or eating watermelon. Picnic where you find a poisonous spider in a picnic basket on Sunday that had killed a girl whose in-laws all hated her. Picnics where you have canned goods that had gone bad, but looked delicious, but had caused the, you know, death of two families. Is it that type of like things that she thinks about? And so they said, you know, if you're looking for an offer that is very much your spider in your picnic kind of author, then I think this would be a really interesting collection for you. And I mean, don't listen to me, listen to like Borges and Calvino and all these like amazing people who think that, you know, she should be read by more people. So this is Thus Were Their Faces by Silvina Ocampo, translated by Daniel Balderston.
I wasn't aware there was like more than one kind of picnic. I thought it was like a fairly straightforward blanket on gross ground, eat food outside.
Apparently not. Apparently about spiders in your picnic basket.
I mean, there can be, I thought ants were like a more traditional bug to do.
That's why this is different, because it's not ants. You expect ants, spiders. That story was also about like these two people just eating, sampling many, many cakes. Just buying slices of cakes and just stuffing their faces. So yeah. Yes, that is the look that I had when I was reading a lot of it too. I'm just like, what is happening here? But yeah.
Okay. So kind of like a tone poem of just like, okay, images and words washing over you and you being like, okay, well, death picnics, death.
Words though. They're good words. They're fun words. They're good words. They're weird words. They are just like, anyway. So what did you decide on your underappreciated books?
Yeah, kind of weirdly enough, I also chose a publisher that I really love, that I think everyone should love, and it should get more love because I feel like they're doing great work. And in a way, I've also kind of like cheated in the same way that you have, in that this author is famous in their home country, but less famous kind of like abroad and in North America, unless you're a fan of like Bungo Stray Dogs, which they are one of the characters who apparently has a basement full of dolls, which after reading his books, I'm like, yeah, that all tracks. That all tracks. Yeah. So I chose, again, one of my favorite publishers that pretty much everything that they publish, I try to get my hands on and I try to order for the library because I think they're just doing really interesting things in a genre that I really love. And this is, if you can't guess, it's Pushkin Vertigo, whom I love so much. I love the little like little symbol that I just now realized is a V and a P. Oh, this is going to be a rough day. I love what they do. They are coming out. Essentially, what they're doing is they're grabbing a bunch of kind of very famous, very kind of like classic detective and mystery stories from different countries, translating them in English, sometimes for the first time, and publishing them with like these really pulpy covers, especially this series and one of my other favorites, because it's going to make it on my list of best books of the year because I love them so much, the Kosuke Kindachi mysteries. Super pulpy. They look like those like 70s slasher thrillers. And this one kind of is no different. So this is Yukito Ayatsuji, which is the pen name of Naoyuki Ushida. And to tie back into your book, Virginia, his wife is Fuyumi Ono, who wrote like the 12 Kingdoms series, which is also extremely famous. So they're like a little like powerhouse couple, like churning out good stuff. He's one of the founders of the Honkaku Mystery Club. And the Honkaku was kind of like a movement of people who wanted to go back to like the traditional mysteries, where kind of like you have all the clues, you have all the information ahead of you, and it's like a challenge between the writer and the reader to see if you can solve it. And this is like really relevant because I recently went to go see A Haunting in Venice, Kenneth Branagh's latest travesty adaptation of an Agatha Christie story, and was so angry and so furious and talked about it and dissected it with my friend for so long, my throat was sore the next morning. I just had a lot to say because I feel like he doesn't actually appreciate the genre and he's trying to do something with it that just doesn't work. And he's just like, he's tearing it apart with his three little hands and he cheated on Emma Thompson. And so I don't care for him. Yeah. And it had nothing to do with the Book of Halloween story. Nothing to do at all. Nothing. Nothing. Michelle Yeoh seemed to be having a great time and she looked good. Her hair was fantastic. Kenneth Branagh's accent and mustache are unacceptable. And what they did with Ariadne Oliver is like, I cannot believe the Agatha Christie Foundation has not come down harder on him. Anyways, I digress. So, about the Honkaku mysteries. They are, again, when you think of like that classical golden age mystery where you have all the clues, all the suspects, there's often a little map so you can try and figure it out. Although maps are kind of pointless for me. I'm just like, oh, I'm sure I'll figure it out. They kind of give you all the information and then it's a lovely, slowly kind of like unfurling of the mystery at the end. And what I really like about this series and then the other series is that it, you know, from like page one, you're in the hands of someone who knows exactly what they're doing. They are like high school essays. Here's my thesis statement, supporting argument, supporting argument, supporting argument, conclusion. There's going to be no stupid, I don't want to give any spoilers for A Haunting in Venice, but whatever, like psychics that kind of show up and maybe there's, the entire plot does not hinge on the fact that maybe there are ghosts, maybe there aren't, like a Scooby-Doo episode. Yeah, it's just, it's there for you. If you choose to solve it, you can have kind of like an enjoyable mental exercise. If you choose not to solve it, you'll be like pleasantly surprised by the end and go, oh, well, that all makes sense. Looking back, I should have figured that out all along. Kind of like the movie Snowman, Mr. Policeman. The clues were there all along. So like, I really appreciate this. I know that these books are quite famous in Japan, but less so here in North America. And so they're slowly kind of going through the back catalogs of these kind of classic mysteries and publishing them. This is actually the second one that has been published in English. The first was the Decagon House Murders. And the book I'm going to talk about is the Mill House Murders, which was published this year. It is a locked room mystery and it is translated by Ho Ling Wong. So again, another book in translation. So Virginia and I like sticking very much in our wheelhouses. As I said, it is a kind of very fun locked room mystery. And the series is actually all about books designed by an architect with, I'm just going to call it bad vibes. Every house that he designs seems to have a very complicated murder take place in it, to the point where like it almost makes me, if I'm going to visit someone's house, I'm like, yeah, and who's the architect here? Oh, it was that guy. Actually, you know what? I'm going to stay home. That's fine. That's fine. Because you'll probably be murdered in like a grotesque way. And this very classically is reminiscent of Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None, in that once a year, a group of acquaintances are invited to the Mill House, which is kind of like this castle-like structure designed by architect with bad vibes. And it is the home of Fujinuma Kichi, who is the son of a great painter. So again, combining my two loves of art and mystery. He was a very well-renowned painter. However, all of his paintings have been purchased by his son. So none of them are currently on display. All of them are kept within this mill house. And for only one time in a year, the son, Fujinuma, invites some kind of like close acquaintances and friends to come and view the paintings for one day and then sends them on their way. And with the exception of these visitors, these are the only people that visit the mill house in the entire year. The only occupants of the house are Fujinuma himself, his live-in housekeeper, his butler, and Yuri, who was the daughter of his father's kind of disciple and protege, who, when he passed away, the daughter kind of came under his guardianship, and he married her, and he kept her captive for so many years and did not allow her to read the newspaper or watch TV, and then just like slowly she became his wife. Yeah, so it's that. So you're not like disposed to enjoy this gentleman. So the visitors that come to this house once a year are an art professor who kind of lives under the shadow of his father's genius. There is a doctor who is a bit of a creep, but an art appreciator. There's an art dealer who's desperate to get his grubby little hands on one of these paintings, a monk who has an almost religious fascination with the artist's work, and this year, an old friend of Fujinuma. Now, many years ago, he and his friend's fiance were in a horrible car accident that left the fiance dead, that destroyed his old friend's ability to paint, and left Fujinuma with horrible burns all over his body and confined to a wheelchair. And because of his condition, he must always wear this still, unnatural mask. Hence the mask on the front of the book. Now, this year they gather together under the kind of like reluctant hospitality of Fujinuma and his very young wife, Yuri. And tensions are running high. Storm is coming in. The electricity is going to be cut off. The road has been blocked off. And what do you know? Oh no, the live-in housekeeper has tumbled to her death. An accident? Probably. But that is not the only tragedy that happens at the mill house that night. Oh no. In the middle of the night, the guests are awakened by a horrible sound. The incinerator in the basement is going when it should not be going. They try to find the monk, but he is nowhere to be found, and nor can they find Fujinuma's old friend. As they walk through the house, they notice that one of the doors is open and a painting is impossibly missing. But that is not the worst thing. As they travel down into the basement where the incinerator is firing at full blast, the doctor, with his steady hands, opens the door, puts the poker in to kind of shift things and see what's burning, and brings out a human head. Well, the natural solution to that is that the missing monk tried to steal the painting and then killed the old friend and threw him in the incinerator to make his getaway. Of course, that only makes sense. But that does not square with legendary detective Shimada Kiyoshi, who was good friends with this monk and just can't imagine him, you know, stealing a painting and or chopping someone into bits and putting them in an incinerator. That seems a little out of character for the man that he knew. And so the next year, when all of these friends gather for their yearly ritual, he decides to invite himself along. And with all the players and characters there, he decides to question the police's solution of what happened that night and uncovers something much, much darker. As I said, this is a classic locked room mystery, each of the characters playing out their roles to absolute perfection. There's like chopped off finger clues, which again, unless you're a fan of the genre, that sounds really weird, but it's actually quite classic. There's a map. There's multiple maps. There's a cast of characters, which was honestly really helpful because I'm not good at names and I usually give people nicknames. And I was like, oh, wait, who's this again? Did they do the murder? No, probably not. It is like an unparalleled, just like perfect quintessential book of the genre and like masterfully carried off, wonderfully done. Even if you see kind of like some of the twists coming, you might not see all of them. And so I can like heartily recommend this kind of like undiscovered gem of the genre, both this, the Decagon House Murders, and the other series in the Pushkin Vertigo series. If you're kind of yearning for that very old school mystery, if you too watched A Haunting in Venice and you're like, why would you make this? What's the point, Ken? Then I can heartily recommend these books. So yeah, that's my book. That's my book, Virginia. That's my pick.
Like you said, we just both went with like, you know, our wheelhouse stuff. But I think that's part of what being, you know, a lot of time underappreciated. Yeah, it's underappreciated by like the general public, but like who cares about them? They're all wrong, right? Like each of us can say that about something. Each of us know something and we're passionate about something. We're devoted fans about something. And there's so many different kinds of books that we all have something that we're like, no, everybody needs to read it. But then I feel like also because we've talked about this before, I think we feel like when everybody reads it, then we don't like it anymore. That's the other side of it. I'm just like, well, like not everybody likes it. Everybody, I'm like, meh.
We read a James Patterson book. We did it.
We did. We totally did.
And I mean, as the saying goes, like to every book, their reader. And it's really nice when you, as like a fan of the genre or like are interested, can find one that you're very passionate about that like doesn't always show up on that extremely mysterious New York Times bestseller. It is wonderful that everyone out there, like that when those 4 million people write those books, that there's someone out there who's going to love it so much. And that's kind of like the wonder of the library, is that you can wander around and like discover that gem, that book that's written just for you, even though the author didn't know it at the moment. And maybe those books will be the books that we talked about today, but maybe not.
For us, it is. That's the important part. Because I'm sure like Sadie or Al or anybody who's listening to me like, what? No thanks, right? But that's okay. That's totally okay. We appreciate you.
We appreciate them. And we're saying like, if you are like us, you too will appreciate this. You're a very specific Venn diagram of all the things that some of us love. You too could enjoy.
I don't know who's in my Venn diagram ever, but okay.
To every podcast book recommender, there is a book podcast listener. And on that like very deep thought, before I make a mistake between like sports and numbers again, we're going to quickly sign off. So thank you so much for listening. We hope that you have some like wonderful underappreciated authors that you're championing out there in your life. Feel free to recommend them to us. And we will definitely give them a try, because any book that someone is passionate about, is interested in, is definitely worth a read, worth a try. All right. Thank you so much. Happy reading. Happy long weekend reading. If you're listening to this on the long weekend, which I don't think you will be, but nonetheless, next long weekend, make it a reading weekend. I'm done now. All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. If you like our show, please tell a fellow book lover about it. You can find a list of all the books we discussed in our show notes. Join us next week for another fun book chat. Until then, keep it fictional.